Welcome to the podcast of MotorWeek, television's original automotive magazine. MotorWeek is made possible by RockAuto.com. Here's your host, John Davis.
And hello, everyone. This is MotorWeek podcast number 83. I am John Davis, and we have a full house today. I'm joined by producer, writer, and two-wheeling reporter Brian Robinson.
What's up, John?
Our road test producer, Ben Davis.
Present.
Writer, Patrick Lucas.
Yeehaw.
And our assistant producer, Greg Carlos.
Hey there.
All right, we've got a lot in store. We have a lightning round, the MotorWeek mailbag. But first, we're going to tackle four cars very quickly that have come across our lot, or at least our attention, in the last few weeks. I'm going to start with a car that probably everyone that's into sports cars has been salivating about ever since we first heard it was really going to be built, and that's the Jaguar F-Type. Dave Scrivener from our staff is just back from having a chance to drive the car, and he's told us a lot about it. But before I get into his impressions, let me kind of go around the table. You've all seen the pictures. You've seen it at the auto shows. What's your impression about the F-Types?
They nailed it.
Well, that's pretty good.
Are we doing it in like three words or less?
No. This is not a tweet. Believe me.
I saw it at Paris when they unveiled it, and it, to me, it looked awesome from a distance. When you get up close, I was kind of surprised the fit and finish, like, the bodywork was pretty lacking, but I guess that was, pre-production and show car. Hopefully they'll get that straightened out, but it's got all the right proportions. It's got a new look to it. I think the bigger story is just what Tata's doing with Jag. I mean, they're pumping a ton of money into it. Got a lot of exciting new products coming. This is just kind of getting it started. Like in 10 years from now, Jag and Land Rover both won't resemble what they are now at all.
I think that goes without saying. I think you're absolutely right. Patrick, any impressions?
I just think, between this and the XK, the high-performance variants of those, Jag's getting real aggressive, and I think it's going to be good for them.
Now, do you think this car, from looks-wise, is going to be as memorable as the
XK? That's what I was thinking.
That's a bold statement, but but maybe for a lot of... No. I mean, in one word, no. But that doesn't mean it's
doesn't
no
mean
less
they didn't
stunning.
Nail it, right?
Yeah. They still nailed it.
Dave had very good things to say about driving it. They had a chance to drive all three engines, the 2.6 supercharged 6s and the supercharged 8. He actually felt that the standard car with the supercharged 6 was just fine. He thinks most people will think that's more than enough power. It was quite adequate for everything they were doing, which was some pretty high-performance stuff. He thought the 40 extra horsepower from the V6S was not as noticeable as he expected. The 8 was effortless, but he had good things to say about that. The car handles extraordinarily well, which you would expect. He thought it was very well sorted out. He did make two comments. He said that if you're expecting this to ride like Jaguar's sedans or like you think Jaguars should because it's a luxury brand, this is a sports car. He said it is taut. It is very tight. It's not rough, but you definitely know you're in a performance machine. The other thing that he had good and bad things to say about is steering. Said the car reacts instantaneously. The steering has a nice weight to it, but it's like most of the modern systems. You don't really feel the road very much. And because this is a sports car, he thought that took away from it a little bit. But all in all, he was very impressed. I think he went over expecting it to be good and felt it was great.
How do you think it's going to fare against its competition? Because it sports a pretty hefty price tag.
It does. The base price is, what, 79? Yeah. So you're right up there against, pretty much what the Corvette, I guess, is going to be coming out of the box.
Yeah, you're skipping the base boxer. You're up more to Boxer S.
Yeah, and the V8 is 90.
This starts at 91 or 92,000. So, I mean.
Huge money.
You got to think critically before you go for that V8.
And then no manual transmission. I'm sure a lot of people are going to harp on that.
I don't know. When you get to that price area, you know, a lot of it has to do with exclusivity. So at least, they're not planning to build a huge number of these cars. It'll be a halo car. So you figure they're probably going to do okay for at least a while, and then they'll probably come up with an RS version or whatever, and it'll do better. But, you are right. You've got it. You got the new Corvette, plus you've got the established cars like the Boxster in there. It's going to get a little crowded.
I do think it'll probably compete more against the Z4 and the Boxster, just because I feel like if you're in the market for a Corvette, you're going to buy a Corvette. You're not looking for
a
Jag or a Porsche or anything. So I think
The Europhile.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
And stay tuned, everybody. We'll have our full test of the Jaguar F-Type coming up in just a couple of weeks on Motor Week. Now let's, as they say, switch gears to something that's very sporty, but a bit more what you'd see every day on the streets. This is the new version, the latest generation of the Lexus IS. Brief history, the IS from day one has been the sports sedan entry from Lexus that was also designed to bring in a younger clientele. This is the third generation car, I believe. The first generation was kind of a yawner. The second generation really did very well.
I like the first generation.
Yeah, you got that backwards. Saying, the first generation was much more exciting than
but
the second.
As far as performance-wise, when you look at the numbers and all, and when the second generation car held its head higher, you're talking, to me, that's my impression. As you can hear, there's substantial disagreement around the table. However, now we have neither one of those cars, though, really caught on. It sold okay, but I'm not sure it brought in the younger, well-heeled buyer like they thought. A lot of competition, 3 Series among others. But as everybody is up in the ante with the new G50 from Infiniti, the ATS from Cadillac, it was time to do something again, and maybe make it a little more of a challenger this time. So, Brian, since you were so outspoken, let me throw it to you. What do you think of the new IS?
I haven't spent a whole lot of time with it. Ben can probably be getting into more details, but
he will.
I think they made it, a little better. I'm not sure that they went far enough, but they're, compared to the other ones, the other cars in the segment, I think they definitely got the comfort and luxury and technology edge. But as far as performance, I'm not sure they went far enough. What do you think,
Ben?
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. You hit the nail. they did firm up everything to compete against 3 Series, A4, and the like. The performance isn't quite on par. There are upper levels with all-wheel drive, and the 350 version of the IS is a barnstormer. But let's say, for instance, a base A4, a base 3 Series is much more sportier than a base IS250.
What does it lack? I mean, this is. I'm sorry. This is a broken record. We've said this basically, I think, 3 generations in a row. What are they missing?
I think it lacks that emotional, spiritual thread that sews you to the vehicle. The feeling that you get when you are in a 3 Series.
Yeah, it's just soft. It's too soft.
And too detached, maybe.
Even with all the trickery and the boyish gauges and all of that on the inside.
Yeah, and those are cool. The one.
It's got the LFA gauges, doesn't it?
Well, they're similar.
The one that slides over. Yeah. I mean, they did a great job design-wise. The car is beautiful inside and out.
And there's a big difference in the F-Sport models. Some of the other Lexus models, F-Sport is just basically a trim package and some electronics. I think you get a better suspension and stuff as well.
And let's not forget that eventually there'll be an ISF.
Right.
That'll be.
I mean, they're already talking about it.
Yeah.
The Patrick, any impressions? I mean, I know you haven't been exposed to the car as much as they.
Yeah,
as
I
Ben
mean,
has.
I do like that they brought, like we've said, the interior from, I guess, the GS is what the model is now. They brought that and styled it very similarly.
As they did the front end. I mean, everything's got the spindle grille.
And it works
now,
well. I just think they borrowed too much from the GS, which is much more of a luxury car. So
I think that's a fair point. I mean, I just, at New York, walking around the Lexus stand, you got to the point where you had to go look at the rear end badging because you were having trouble telling one vehicle apart from the other. And for that, there's always been something about a 3 Series that stood out from the other BMWs, whether it was just proportions, but it usually was more than that. Their take on the traditional styling was a little bit different. So anyway, I guess our early impression of the Lexus IS was a very great effort, but maybe still too much of a Lexus.
That's not a bad thing necessarily.
There's certainly a lot of people
and
that want
selling,
that, though.
They're selling decent numbers of them, But are they going to bring in, let's face it, is a 3 Series buyer really going to buy anything else?
Right.
Well, let's just put one way to put it is you're not going to see these on weekend autocross tracks. Probably.
Let me ask you the question this a different way. We've been saying all along we've picked the Cadillac ATS as our, you know, car of the year. We're saying, you know, Cadillac never intended this to take buyers away from the 3 Series. They want to play in the sandbox, and they've got a very competitive vehicle. Do we feel that way about the IS?
If you're talking ultimate track performance sports sedan, then no, they're not even close. But again, I think they, as far as luxury feel and comfort and just technology, I think they got an edge up on everybody on that stuff.
Yeah, I mean the ATS feels a little more grassroots, if that makes any sense, sure, than the Lexus IS does.
Speaking of grassroots, the next car we're going to talk about is the new, renewed, if you please, Honda Civic, a car that basically virtually every journalist found fault with when they redid it a little over a year ago. We found less fault with it than some, but it pretty much got the interior and exterior panned. Impacted sales briefly, but that was probably more because of the tsunami than anything else. Now they've done a mid-cycle redo after only a little over a year. And what do you folks think about the results? Worth it?
Yeah, the big issue was the interior quality and materials. And you can tell they spent a lot of money in to take that up. And then they got rid of the ultra-base DX model, which no one bought anyway. So instead of starting at 16 grand now, it starts at 18. But you get a much nicer interior. They did some NVH work, put some thicker glass in to make it a little quieter, and worked on the ride and handling some. You know, it's not a dramatic change, but it's a little nicer, which it needed to be.
Boy, you get inside, you sure can tell it's changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the piece together look that was there, even though the shape is the same and all that, it's a big difference.
Yeah, I just remember it was a very comfortable base car. I mean, and that's what we had in here. It didn't really have any of the bells and whistles, you know. It was just kind of get in and drive. And, you know, I remember it being real comfortable seats. I remember that was probably written down a few times on our, comment sheet. It's a Honda, solid Honda, well done on the inside. You know, the exterior restyling I don't think was, you know, a massive overhaul, but enough to, you know, make the critics happy, I guess. And I agree. And, you know, good looking car.
Patrick, any comment?
I think it does exactly what you expect it to. And I think that's a good thing.
You know, this is really interesting what's going on. This car, after basically getting panned by the press more than the public, a little over a year, they went and spent a lot more money to fix it up. The Chevy Malibu is getting the same treatment this fall after about, a year and a half on the streets. It's going to get a substantial redo because both the critics found fault with the back seat and some other things like the style of the dash. Again, same kind of thing. But also the public, too, because they look at it and say it's not as roomy as some of its competition. And the whole time we've been in business on Motor Week, over 30 years, we've never seen this kind of really substantial one-year-later update. Do you think this is the trend of the future?
Yeah, I think so. With everything else, development cycles have sped up so much. I mean, they can get a car out there in like 18 months, 2 years now, where it used to be a 4 or 5 year affair. I think maybe, I mean, they could have had some of this in the works before the car even came out. I mean, you know, they have internal people that, you know, check everything out. Maybe they, when they put it out, maybe they even knew it wasn't up to par.
But they've never had, just never spent the money like this before. I mean, it is money that they're, you know, they are spending. They're not, you know, it's probably not hundreds of millions, but let's say they're spending a substantial amount. It strikes me that maybe the public is just showing that because everybody wants things so instantaneous, there's people aren't going to wait. Well,
they're probably also getting the feedback or, you know,
quicker,
faster because of Twitter, Facebook, everything.
Yeah,
and, you know, yeah, I mean, they're talking with the consumer more than they ever have before. So, you know, immediately the consumers are, you know, voicing their pleasure or displeasure with it. And, you know, the car manufacturers know immediately about it now, and, you know, they're making notes and what they can change. And if they have enough complaints, I'm sure they go, you know, right away and change it.
Yeah, there's so much ripple effect now. It just takes a couple people to bash it, and then it just everyone just piles on and piles on, you know.
Speaking of piling on and, you know, rippling effect and getting change.
The chances.
Well, you know, you're just setting me up. Mazda 6. This is the all-new car. It is bigger. It is no longer made in Flat Rock, Michigan. It's now imported. It has their latest Mazda styling, which is very aggressive. How do you guys think about this car? What do you think of it? Is this a true competitor now to Camry and Accord and Fusion, et cetera? Is it still a different kind of animal? What's your thoughts?
It should be a good, you know, strong competitor to the two because it, it's a really good handling car, you know. And you know, even though it's got the 2.5 Sky Active, it's not overly fast, but, you know, really good-looking car, I think. It's... I just don't think that it can really compete with Camry and Accord yet.
Why?
It's just, it's a Mazda, you know.
So you're saying it's not as well known.
It's just not as well, exactly. You know, Camry
but,
and...
What about important things to a family like interior room? Because that was what the old car lacked. Any comments?
They're taking great strides there. A lot more room, especially in the back seat, although the trunk, I think, is smaller. But... I think it's better. It's definitely better, but it still is what it is. I don't think it's going to compete strongly with Camry and Accord either, just because it still has a personality that's different than those.
How would you describe it?
Well, they go with the whole zoom zoom thing, which I'm not sure I've ever 100% bought into, but because they don't handle that great, but it's just the feel of the car more than anything else. The seating position, where the you can still get a manual shifter, and just the way everything fits inside, it feels like a very sporty car compared to Camry and Accord or just basically generic transportation. So I don't think it really competes with them, but I think they have more of the pieces in place, but I don't think they ever want to be looked at as a Camry or an Accord.
Ben, any comments?
Wow, that was a lot to take in, wasn't it?
We've had two of them in here, we should say. We've had both the manual and the automatic.
Beautiful cars from the outside. I wasn't as impressed with the interior design, but they do handle great, I think.
What struck me is sort of playing off what Brian Robinson said. When you get in it, the first thing I noticed was that the dash is low, where most traditional four-door midsize sedans, the dash is very high. So the steering wheel does not have as much rake up-down movement, so you have to have the steering wheel down fairly low to see the gauges, even if you're 6 foot tall. And then that means you have the seat low, so you've got a decent driving position. And lo and behold, you think, you know, I'm not in a sedan. I'm in a coupe. Not quite a sports car, maybe, but I'm darn close to the road where everybody else is trying to get you up higher to give you that crossover utility kind of feel. That right there makes this a very different car, I think, as far as from the driver's point of view. Seems very roomy. It does have, I remember decades ago we called Mazda the, you know, trying to be the Asian BMW, and I couldn't help but be struck by how similar the instrument panel was to kind of BMW themes with the info screen high above the air vents, and even came down to having a pseudo iDrive system, which kind of left us all cold, I think.
It's like, what does it do?
Well, there's three sets of buttons. You've got the iDrive.
Swung and a miss there.
Is it what? Swung and a miss. Yeah. You got the stuff on the iDrive controller. You got the same things on the screen of the radio, and you got the stuff on the radio on the steering wheel. It's like there's triple redundancy here.
Yeah, and especially since the buttons on the controller are the exact same as what's around the touchscreen. You know, when you're driving, it's much easier just to reach over the touchscreen, not reach down, figure out what buttons you're looking at, and then go from
there.
Did
you ever think we were going to be saying what you just said, that it was easier to use a touchscreen than something else?
I'm never sure that I'm going to say what I just said, so
it's not a problem. It does strike me that they should have put some other different radio face in there or something. But I think it's a different midsize sedan that you won't see yourself coming down the block. And if you're driver-oriented, you'll probably be happy about that.
It does look great. It really does.
It's refreshing in the segment.
Yeah, I don't know if it's as good-looking as a Fusion or not, but it definitely stands out. What do you guys think? Good as a Fusion or better?
I think it's right up there in terms of how drastic it was and how people receive it.
I thought the Fusion was, you know, really, really good-looking. But then when I saw the 6, the Fusion I think it's still a little bit better. But, you know,
really, yeah, because the 6
tightened the gap.
I will say we've got the 6 we have in red. I think just really it's a gorgeous car.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much for that. And let's move on now to our lightning round. Our panelists have 2 minutes to debate a trending automotive topic. And when time is up, our producer, Michelle Parker will step in here with the bell. There it is. And she'll hopefully get us to be quiet. Here we go. As we just discussed, the Honda Civic. Yeah, this is the same question we went over already.
I already did this.
I guess I was reading ahead. The Honda Civic got an emergency refresh following sharp criticism of its 2012 model. The 13 Chevy Malibu is under fire. Are there any other vehicles out there that you think are in need of a makeover sooner rather than later? Here we go.
Somebody's ready. We were all unanimous on this one. At least a few of us were. The Sentra.
The Sentra.
Yeah, I was talking to Ben.
This is the new Sentra, folks.
Yeah, if you took that Sentra and put it in a lineup of brand new cars from like 10 years ago, it would not stand out at all.
I couldn't agree more, dear.
It was a great car.
I pointed the LED lights out to you. You weren't in favor of those either. They kind of look like an afterthought.
Putting it right out there.
That's what I we were
all right.
I thought the same.
Let's get it. I don't want to beat this car to death, but let's get into it. Is it just styling? Is it that it doesn't stand out?
I think so. I mean, it drove fine. I liked the drive. Well, I could live with it.
I remember the a few times we had three people in the car and nobody wanted to sit in the passenger seat because it was too high and it just it was an uncomfortable seating position. And, you know, I had the chance to sit in and I'd have to agree. It was just it's like if you had the choice between the front passenger or the back, it's like, I'll just sit in the back.
Because it's so roomy. It's got so much legroom.
It still has the fantastic CVT system.
Oh, yeah. And it's, yeah, it is a good CVT if there is such a thing, but still. Anything else?
I would say the entire Buick brand, not the GM bash, but I think they could keep tweaking. I mean, they're working on it, but, I mean, they got a ways to go.
You know, interesting you said that. I think that this latest iteration of the big crossovers, the Enclave, the Traverse, and the Acadia, they pretty much invented that market for these 7 and 8 passenger, almost as big as the Suburban CUVs. They've refreshed them. They are selling well. I should point out, despite what critics are saying, but they didn't go far enough. You know, they're not up with the best out there. And before they were leading it. And I hate to see that. You know, they need to put some more money in them. All right. They don't even have push to start ignition.
Come on. Anybody else got anything?
Okay. I was going to say the GMC Terrain.
Oh, he was listening to GM bashing.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That Terrain, I just didn't want to look at that car.
Well, it's about due for a thorough makeover, so it's coming soon anyway. All right, let's go on to the Motorweek mailbag. Remember to submit your question, and if you choose, rather we choose your answer to use on the podcast, Greg Carlos will bring you a fabulous Motorweek T-shirt.
And a Nissan Sentra.
Here we go. And actually, we have a note from another Greg that asked, I just finished watching your show. Thank you for that. I noticed the fuel filler door on the new Camaro is on the passenger side. I've wondered for years why the auto manufacturers don't agree on a standard place for them on either the driver or passenger side only. I have no idea.
It's because they've installed cameras in every gas station. They're just like watching you go from side to side.
unless the federal government mandates that they put it on one side, it's probably designers' choice.
Well, it used to be mandated, I believe, in Asia. They had to be, they drive on the opposite side of the road.
In Japan.
Yeah, in Japan, correct. And it had to be on the left side of the vehicle so that if you had ran out of gas and needed to put gas in your car, you would be away from traffic.
You wouldn't be standing in the
road. Makes the most sense.
And so, but I don't think that really, I'm not sure it applies anymore or not.
Well, the logic would say that you'd want it on the driver's side just because of not only what you point out, but also because you get out, the pump's right there, and you put the gas in. You're not walking around. I mean, gas stations these days can be pretty dangerous places to be walking around in.
I'd rather see it on the passenger side because aesthetically, I don't look at the passenger side. I enter and leave to the driver's side, and a lot of times, gas doors, clean and slick. Exactly.
I think it comes down to packaging more than anything else.
I like back in the 50s when they were hidden behind taillights
and license plates in the 60s.
Yeah. Definitely bring that back.
Yeah, my old Buick Regal had it behind the license plate.
Yeah.
So the answer, Greg, to your question is we have no clue except as it just seems to be at the whim of the designer. It has to do with where they put the gas tank relative to the seats and whatever else is trying to vie for interior space. It doesn't seem you'd pretty much find the German manufacturers put it on
passenger side.
Side. And the Europeans, I think, in general do that. And like my Mini has it on the driver's side, but that's because they drive on the right in England. And so it would be on the passenger side. But American and Asian car, maybe it's mostly just American cars tend to have it all over the place. Yeah. Okay, so that wraps up this Motorweek podcast number 83. Seems like only yesterday we did number one. And we'd like to thank our audio engineer, Jillian Cookman. This is her first podcast. Thank you, Jillian, very much for making us come through loud and clear. Our podcast creator, Bill Mixter. And as always, our podcast producer, Michelle Parker, who I refer to as the lady with the bell. And thank you all. And thanks, everyone, for not only listening to our podcast, but watching Motor Week every week on your local public television stations and also on Velocity. Till next time, I'm John Davis. Thanks for watching and listening to Motor Week.
You've been listening to the podcast of Motor Week, television's original automotive magazine. Motor Week is made possible by RockAuto.com. For additional information on podcasts, videos, and showtimes, visit our website at MotorWeek.org. And watch Motor Week, television's longest-running automotive series, each week on your local PBS station.